afternoon. You are tuned into Juno Afternoon here for Tuesday, the 27th of October, the year 2016. Excuse me, that's September. Today on the show, Ruth Johnson from Cancer Connection will be here to highlight the Saturday's Health Forum. We'll get an update on family support groups for those struggling with heroin and other opiate use. Find out about the nomination process for the Governor's Awards for the Arts. Teacher and director Bob Meyer will be here to talk about the Thundermount High School production, The Diary of Anne Frank. That Writer's Almanac, Murder Note, Music and More today on Juno Afternoon. Well, the forecast for tonight, scattered showers, low temperatures with a low around 41 degrees. Forecast for Wednesday, scattered showers before 1 in the afternoon, cloudy skies and high temperatures near 53 degrees.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The 8th and final Obama administration Tribal Nations gathering was held Monday in Washington, D.C. Matt Laszlo was there and has this report on President Obama's legacy and how many tribal leaders are worried the gains made by the administration could erode when Obama leaves office.
A big part of President Obama's legacy with tribal leaders is that he took the time to listen to the concerns of people from Indian country, while also appointing many Native Americans to key positions inside his administration. In his address, the president went through a list of areas he's worked with Native and Alaska leaders on.
Together, we've permanently protected sacred lands for future generations. We've restored more than 428,000 acres of tribal homelands to their original owners. By signing the historic Cobell Settlement into law, we established the Land Buyback Program, a $1.9 billion fund to consolidate individual Indian lands and restore them to tribal trusts. Together, we strengthen your sovereignty.
President Obama added,
today, the most important thing I want to say is thank you. After almost 8 years as your president, I have been so privileged to learn from you and spend time with many of you while visiting more tribal communities than any other president.
After two terms, President Obama is preparing for retirement in January, and that has some tribal leaders worried. Chief Roger Hill of the Seneca Nation in New York, he's dubious of both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton when it comes to Indian country.
The two candidates, you know, that are in the running, I'm not sure which one is the lesser of the evil.
Joseph Hawley is chairman of the Battle Mountain Band Council in Nevada. He says President Obama set up a good apparatus for Indian country that he hopes will outlast his time in the White House.
I mean, Obama set up something really nice to go forward with and continue doing, you know, and actually dealing with the Native people. So we got no problem on that end. It's just getting them to follow through with the rules that they are set.
But Hawley says it doesn't really matter who replaces Obama because the federal government has obligations to tribes. He says officials just need to live up to them. For National Native News, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
Canada is playing host to a royal visit. The Duke and Duchess of Cambridge, Will and Kate, and their children are on an 8-day visit to British Columbia and Yukon. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, interacting with First Nations communities is part of the trip.
One of the first major stops during the visit was to the Great Bear Rainforest and the tiny First Nations community of Bella Bella, which lies in the heart of the region. The royal visit to the community was to add the rainforest to the Queen's Commonwealth Canopy, an effort launched last year to protect forests throughout the 53-nation British Commonwealth. The environment is one of the issues that Prince William has championed.
When we protect our rivers, oceans, atmospheres, or like today our forests, we are telling our children that their future prosperity cannot be disconnected from the health of the natural world.
Earlier this year, the province of British Columbia, along with First Nations along the coast, announced more protection for the area, 85% of which is protected against industrial logging. Kelly Brown is the Director of Resource Management for the Heiltsuk First Nation.
And so we're very grateful to be able to collaborate with the Queen in relationship to conservation and protecting the environment. Not only for our people, but for the rest of the world. That's how important we feel it is. Because the Heiltsuk territory and the Great Bear Rainforest is one of the last pristine areas throughout the world.
Not everything went smoothly so far with the royal visit. The Grand Chief of the Union of BC Chiefs, Stuart Phillip, refused to attend a ceremony at the provincial legislature. He said he could not attend a reconciliation ceremony when so many First Nations communities are in deep poverty and little is being done to improve Native child welfare policies across the country. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
Support for this program is provided by the Native American Rights Fund, reminding you that sovereignty is not free. Native American Rights Fund has been helping Indian tribes for over 40 years with critical issues such as treaty enforcement, hunting and fishing rights, Indian child welfare, religious freedom, and more. You too can become a modern-day warrior with your support for NARF's work. Learn more at narf.org and join the fight for Native rights.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
It's 6 minutes past the hour, and you're tuned to KTOO News in Juneau. Our next guests are here to talk about NCADS, Family Support Group, for those suffering with heroin and other opiate addictions. Katie Chapman from NCADS is here, and also Lisa is in the room to talk about her experiences. Thank you for coming down to the station today.
Thank you for having us.
Katie, could you paint me a picture of NCADS?
Yeah, so NCADD is the National Council on Alcoholism and Drug Dependence, and we are the Juneau affiliate of the national organization, which is headquartered in New York. At NCADD, we do a number of things. Our mission is to provide help and hope to those struggling with substance use disorders, and we do that through a number of programs. Some are prevention programs. We also have clinical services. We work with families to do interventions, and we have an overdose prevention program. We have Narcan, also known as naloxone, available for the public. And we recently started a family support group here with Lisa, who is a family member and came to us to ask for some support and help in establishing a group.
What do we know about the process of addiction compared to what we didn't know years ago?
Sure. So, what we know about addiction is, what we teach families and individuals at NCAD is it's based on a biopsychosocial model. So there's a number of factors that contribute to the process. In part, it could be a person's genetic makeup. It could also be some emotional underlying mental health causes that contribute to addiction, and also a person's social environment, right? Like whether or not they have access to drugs and alcohol, or their peers are using it. That can also play a part in a person's ability to abuse substances or become addicted. The way we talk about it at CADD is we educate families that it is a chronic brain disease characterized by impaired social functioning. There's a potential for tolerance to develop and withdrawal to happen, and that if a person doesn't get treatment, it can be progressive and possibly fatal.
What about the way we treat people with addiction? How has that changed over the years?
What we're finding is that some people are choosing pathways for treatment through medication-assisted treatment, so getting getting some psychotherapy along with buprenorphine or Suboxone. That's particularly for the population of people who are experiencing opioid dependence. So that's something that's new and newer to our community. I think that we'll probably start to see more medication-assisted treatment options available in Juneau.
Lisa, you're involved with the support group. What happens to the support group?
Well, first I want to say that the support group is a safe place for parents or family members to come. We all have a common denominator that we're all dealing with someone with substance abuse. And so it's a safe place to come and talk about it. It's a closed group, unless you have a family member with a substance abuse problem, you can't attend. So everyone's on the same page there. We offer support and resources. And mostly this group is about the parents' trauma, helping the parents cope with this traumatic experience, which is broad and difficult.
What's been your experience as far as dealing with the people who are addicted?
Well, one of the hard experiences for me as a parent is when someone's addicted to, like, heroin, their brain isn't functioning correctly. So they've lost some of their executive decision-making skills, and it's really hard to get through, even in a conversation. So that's difficult. And they lie constantly, so you never know exactly what's going on, and it's communication is tough.
I imagine the support group is just one way, one tool that one has when they're fighting addiction.
The support group?
Mm.
Yes, it's tools for the family to heal themselves, basically is what this is about, because we can't fix our child. You try to fix them, you go try, you try all these different things to get them to go to rehab, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't, but what you end up with is that you're helpless in that regard. So we are here to help the families become stronger.
How long do the meetings last, and where? How often do they occur?
They're every Wednesday night from 5:30 to 7. And the first half hour, we usually have a guest speaker, a counselor, or different clinic people, and to give us some resources. And then the next hour is just the sharing part, where the speaker leaves, and we're in a very confidential group, and we all talk a lot.
Right. We also have, we'll make available an overdose prevention training and provide family members with a Narcan kit after the support group, too, if they want one. And we've created like this table, a little library, I guess we could call it, of resources that have helped the family members, different books that they've read, that they've learned something from. And so we have all of those out for people to take from.
You mentioned that only family members were invited. What about someone who's close to an individual but is not technically a family member?
Well, you know, we certainly wouldn't turn anyone away, but what this group has talked a lot about and what they've identified is that their experience is unique. To be a parent of an adult son, I mean, I guess it could be an adolescent too, but so far it's mostly been parents of their adult children who are struggling with addiction. And that experience is unique for them. And I'll let Lisa comment on that.
Well, I think it's hard not being a parent to understand that connection and that hurt, although I'm not saying that other people couldn't. I mean, there are people and families that are close that maybe aren't parents. But there's a special, everyone in that group right now is a parent. And there's a special bond in the group and with your child when you're a parent and your child is suffering, that I don't know if someone who's not a parent could understand it in the same way, truthfully.
How do you deal with it?
Deal with?
Your family member who lies to you, and otherwise it may be difficult to deal with.
Well, you try to support them, you know, saying you'll help them and care for them, but it's really hard to deal with them. Sometimes you don't even know where they are, and all you want to do is know that they're alive. And
so one thing that we've done a lot in our support group is we've helped family members to distinguish between, you know, what their loved one and their active addiction, like what their active addictive self, how they're behaving versus, you know, their resilient normal son or daughter as they know them as their son or daughter, right? Like distinguishing between the two, that these behaviors, maybe the lying, the stealing, committing crimes, like that's all a part of this illness. You know, like Lisa was commenting on their brain, you know, their brains are changing. This is a brain disease. They're not able to make decisions and make choices that would seem to make sense to the rest of the world, you know, the rest of us who are standing by watching. And so in our family support group, we really try to help the family members see that's the addiction and the symptoms that come with that. That's not your son or daughter who you love and have raised. You know, that's like, we have to distinguish between the two and just keep finding ways for these family members to cope and learn how to heal and be informed about all of the resources, so that when and if their loved one is ready for treatment, they can help them get right in.
What does treatment consist of?
Treatment can consist, that could look different for different people. I think the family members have various experiences with treatment.
Well, there's not enough treatment in Juneau. That's a problem. There's no detoxing, particularly here. There's really no place to go, very limited resources. So that's a huge difference.
Well, that's with regards to the detox, and that's one subject that comes up a lot in our family support group. When a person's detoxing from opiates, there isn't really a lot that the emergency room can do. That tends to be where families want to take their loved one, is to the emergency room, right? It seems like that would make sense if your loved one is, uncomfortable and in pain, but they're not really able to, unless the symptoms are so severe that they could be fatal, they're not able to really hold them and support them. You know, at NCADD, when families come to us and ask us about options for detox, we encourage people to go contact their family physician. Detox for opiates can happen on an outpatient basis. So the detox issue comes up a lot. In fact, we had one group where the whole discussion was all about family members' experience of detoxing their children at home and what that was like. It's a common experience for these family members. I think for treatment, some individuals want long-term treatment. They want to go to places where they can get help for more than 30 days, 28 or 30 days, and we don't have those options here in Juneau. So it's a matter of helping families, find what's available outside of Juneau at times to see what works for them within their budget and that offers, ideally evidence-based best practice treatments that can help their son or daughter.
Has the problem gotten worse over the years, or is it our awareness of it has gotten more highly?
I think both. I think that there's definitely more discussions that are taking place in our community, which I believe is going to be contributing toward the solution. You know, there is this awareness, and we see that there are policies changing that will, facilitate people getting the help that they need.
How can people find out more about your support group?
Well, you can call us at 463-3755, and you can also go to our website, which is NCADDJuno.org.
Is there anything else to share?
Well, I just hope more parents will listen, hear this, and feel safe to come. I know there are some people that are hesitant. I don't know if but it's really a safe place, and I think once they get there, one meeting, and they'll start feeling better.
Were you hesitant to go to your first meeting?
Well, I kind of started the group with so I was actually pretty anxious to go to my first meeting, and it's turned out to be a really great group, and very supportive, very helpful. I'm experiencing what I was looking for in starting a group, and that's learning how to cope with this trauma.
What are some of the warning signs? You mentioned lying.
Well, I think in my case, and then a lot of other parents from listening to them, is that you don't even realize sometimes what's going on. There might be some red flags, like they don't show up to as many family gatherings, or they stop communicating, and then the lying about everything and trying to get money and so forth. I think there's a lot of warning signs, but I didn't see them for a long time. And then when you do, when it happens, you start realizing what's going on, you kind of go into this shock and disbelief and wanting not to think that's really what's happening. And and then you start trying to figure out how to fix it immediately. And that is difficult.
Where did you go, and who did you talk to when you first became aware of the problem?
Well, I didn't talk to a lot of people because I was, there's a lot of secrecy involved in this, and shame and being ashamed, and I've gotten over that mostly. But I went to a counselor, a drug addiction counselor, and took some of my other family members so we could understand what was going on.
So you went to a local professional who gave you a presentation about the disease of addiction in the brain. And so Lisa shared with me that you know, getting more education was helpful. And then where else did you reach out to?
Well, it took me a while to get to
the I'm like pointing out myself to us,
but,
right?
But, you know, you go on the Internet and you start reading about it and you find, you know, other groups and support somewhat. But I really wanted a group, you know, not on the Internet, and where we can sit and talk and really share. And that took a long time for me to get to that point. And then when I realized that there wasn't a lot here, that's when I went to NCAD and found out what a great organization that is. And then they were so helpful. We just got on it and started the group right away.
How much of this is, I'm not sure, I don't want to just, The pharmaceutical industry, their ability to prescribe opiates.
Right. Well, I think that there's just a number of factors that contribute to this. The pharmaceutical industry is one. I think that there's a need for education about pain management and alternatives rather than opiate prescriptions, although, like, some people absolutely need those and should have those. There's a number of factors that our agency is exploring through. We recently received some funding from the Department of Behavioral Health to focus on prevention for prescription abuse, misuse, and heroin use among the ages of 12-year-olds to 25-year-olds here in Juneau. And so we're just getting started with that project. It's going to be a process of gathering some data to really understand what the prevalence of this issue is in our community and then identify what some strategies will be to address it.
I'm talking with Katie Chapman and Lisa about the problem we have here in Juneau about opiates and heroin. Could you give me that phone number again, Mom?
Sure. NCADD's phone number is 463-3755.
And the website?
NCADDjuno.org.
Is there anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
If you're a family member and you're concerned about, you know, your son or daughter who may be struggling with addiction, please come to the support group. Like Lisa said, I think, you know, we've created a pretty safe, confidential space. It's free. Just show up, and you're welcome to share or just listen. We definitely have made the first part of the meeting be an opportunity to receive some education and learn about resources locally. And so please call us if you have questions.
And the group is basically parent-run, so you can come to the group and bring ideas and what you'd like to learn, what you'd like to talk about. So it's kind of a cooperative.
Right. Lisa and I co-facilitate together, and so it's, you know, I'm stepping back more. I'm just there to kind of hold the space, and Lisa's has been a leader among the parents. So it's been a very positive experience, I think.
What would you say to other people who are on the fence about going to a meeting?
Well, gosh, I mean, I'm always reminding the family members in the group that, you know, you can't fix your loved one, and, you know, you didn't cause their addiction, you can't control it, and there really isn't a cure for it, but there are supports and resources to help with, with healing for both the person who's addicted and the family members, and it's a complex issue, I think. It affects families deeply, so if you're on the fence about it, I guess, give us a call and we'll share more information with you and consider it. What would you say?
Well, I'd just say there is hope.
Yeah. Right. I mean, we have this week and next week, we've got two individuals who are in recovery that are going to come to the parent group to share their experience. And that's exactly what they're going to be given a lot of is hope to show that it's possible that people can get well and find a pathway to recovery that works for them and contribute and just be successful, awesome people in our community. So it's possible.
Listen, Katie, thanks again for coming by.
Thanks.
popped a lot of pills. But I've never touched nothing that my spirit could kill. You know, I've seen a lot of people walking around with tombstones in their eyes. But the pusher don't care. Ah, oh, if you live or if you die. God damn the pusher.
It's the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday, September 27th, 2016. It was on this date, 1825, the first steam-powered passenger railway began service in England. Train went from Shildon to Stockton, preceded by a man on horseback carrying a banner that read Periculum Privatum Utilitas Publica, the private danger is the public good. About 600 people aboard, most of them riding in open coal cars, the dignitaries in a passenger coach. The inventor of the steam engine, George Stephenson, rode on the footplate. A brass band boarded the train at Yarm to complete the journey. It's the birthday of Jack Kerouac's girlfriend, Joyce Johnson, born New York City, 1935. She wrote a book about it, Minor Characters, A Young Woman's Coming of Age, in the beat orbit of Jack Kerouac. She wrote, "Artists are nourished more by each other than by fame or by the public. To give one's work to the world is an experience of peculiar emptiness. The work goes away from the artist into a void, like a message stuck into a bottle and flung into the sea." It's the birthday of the Scottish novelist Irvine Welsh, born Edinburgh, 1957, best known for his novel Trainspotting, about a group of heroin addicts in Edinburgh. He was a high school dropout, TV repairman, moved to London, be part of the punk rock scene, got addicted to heroin, then he quit drugs, cold turkey. He fell off the top deck of a London bus, got a nice cash settlement, used it to buy up property, fix it up and sell it at a profit, moved back to Edinburgh, got his MBA, started writing about his teenage years. He got an agent, and out came Train Spotting, a violent, strange, crude book written in a combination of standard English and Scots dialect. It was nominated for the Booker Prize, but two judges objected to the violence, and it was withdrawn from the list. He was asked why his books are so violent. Irvine Welsh said, "Well, everyone that writes has their own area of inquiry, and mine has always been kind of, why is it that when life can be so hard and difficult, we compound it by self-sabotage, doing terrible things? That's always been my main area of inquiry, and it does lead you to dark places." Here's a poem for today by Carrie Shippers, Dispatch. "This is not an emergency," I say, when Mom picks up. She answers, "Hold on, we're getting a page." Two electronic tones, the call numbers that follow. As a teenager, I listened to the police scanner in our kitchen, taught myself the radio codes that told me where she was, what she was putting right. Today, I wait without hearing anything I understand. She's used to waiting for calls to come in, units to go out, her shift to end. She says she doesn't miss the ambulance, hefting cots and equipment, the urgent drives. As a dispatcher, she gets to stay inside, wear her own clothes, go home unbloodied. On the night shift, she reads cookbooks and crime novels next to her keyboard, wanting and not wanting something to happen. Mornings at my desk, I imagine her voice sending sirens exactly where they're needed. Dispatch, poem by Carrie Shippers from Family Resemblances, published by University of New Mexico Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Lumosity with a 10-minute fit test to calculate baseline scores and training programs with 50 challenging brain games. Learn more at lumosity.com. And by TIAA, whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. Learn more at TIAA.org. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
It's about 32 minutes past the hour in the hour, 32 minutes before the end of the hour in the orchard of Juno afternoon. I'm in the studio now with Justin Schleppi and Linda, Lillian Bannerman. They're students at Thurmond High School taking part in The Diary of Anne Frank, which is their next play coming up. Thanks for coming in the station today.
Thank you very much.
For people who don't know the play, can you describe the plot, please?
Well, it's about a young girl, Anne Frank, and her journey through the Holocaust because she was Jewish, and so her and her entire family had to go into hiding in the attic of her father's old business place, and it's all about them living in such cramped quarters and how their life really was during the Holocaust.
It's an interesting way to explore the world of history.
Very. It's a roller coaster, the entire play. It has its ups and downs, and it really shows the stress that the Holocaust had on these people and these families that had to go into hiding. So it's very stressful, but then at the same time, there's really sweet moments, too. So,
how many people are in the cast?
There's 13 members. We have 8 people who are staying in the annex the entire time, and there's 2 people that come up that supply the members of the 2 families in the annex with supplies, foods, books, rations. And then in the very end, there are, of course, the 3 individuals that come in and end the play. So,
what's your role in the play?
I play Otto Frank, Anne's father.
And I play Anne Frank.
How did the play get picked? It's an appropriate time for it, that's for sure.
With this, well, we have a very particular cast we have this year. It's a very astute individuals that have a lot of experience. And with this play, it's a very serious topic. And we wanted to pick something that was appropriate for both the audience and the cast that we had. And our director, Dr. Barbara Dromeyer, she felt that with the cast we have, it was an appropriate message to send and an appropriate way to capture what this play really means, which is the course of the struggles that they had to go through.
What's it like, Lillian?
Well, it's a lot of fun playing Anne Frank, but at the same time, it's nerve-wracking because she's such an iconic role in history, and she was so optimistic during the Holocaust, and it's crazy to see that because throughout the play, I get to be this happy little girl, but when I read about the Holocaust, everything's pretty much sad. So it's really cool to play her, but also scary because I have to act out everything that she did and hope that I do it as best as I can.
How do you prepare yourself for the performance of the play?
Well, this is only my second play, so I've pretty much just been trying to learn how to memorize lines and trying my best to be emotionally attached to the play, but not too emotionally attached where it affects how I perform.
Is your first theatrical experience?
It's my second. Last year I had a small part in Shrek the Musical, but this is the first time I've ever actually had more than two lines.
Justin, how about you?
I'm in a really interesting situation. So for the last few years I've had different roles in, of course, productions of sorts. I've been in our orchestra, of course, so I've had the opportunity to perform. But never in the same aspect as theater. This is my first play I've ever done in my high school career, which is a really, really cool experience. And with this cast, they're very supportive, and I really enjoy that, and it's been really helpful in welcoming me into this environment. So this is my first production.
What's the run of the play?
It can go up to an hour and a half with a 15-minute intermission between, I believe.
10 minutes.
Ten.
And when is opening night?
October 7th at 7 p.m.
All right, Justin, Sleppy, and Lillian Bannerman, anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
I think that's perfect. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is Bird Note. It's a cool morning in late September. Two young great horned owls are roosting alongside their parents, perched out of view in a dense stand of trees. Compared to the adults, the owlets are a richer brown, and their cat-like ear tufts are a bit shorter. Otherwise, the four birds look alike. Compared to many birds, young great-horned owls remain with their parents a long time. Robins, for example, are fending for themselves only 6 weeks after they hatch. Our owlets are now almost 7 months old. These two hatched in early March, from eggs laid in late January. The mother incubated the eggs for a month, never once leaving the nest. During that month, the male great-horned owl was the sole provider. By April, both parents were hunting through the night. They airlifted in meal after meal to the rapidly growing young. Everything from delectable ducks to smelly skunks. But for the last 2 weeks, the adults have not fed the young, and they are hearing about it. Today could be the final day the family group roosts together. For any night now, the young owls will strike out on their own, moving beyond the home territory of their birth. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
Hi, this is Lauren from the Treadwell Arena, located at 105 Sevico Road in Douglas. Treadwell Arena is open 7 days a week, offering drop-in open skating, pond hockey, and a variety of special events. We are the proud home of the Crimson Bears hockey team, plus youth and adult hockey and figure skating programs. For more details of our programs and a complete schedule of events, visit us online at treadwellarena.org, call 586-0410, and like us on Facebook.
About 20 minutes before the hour, you're tuned to Juno Afternoon. Our next guest is coming to us by the telephone from Anchorage, Cameron Perez-Verdia from the Alaska State Council on the Arts. Cameron, thank you for coming by on the station today.
Sure. I'm actually from the Alaska Humanities Forum, though.
Okay.
But thank you. I'm glad to be on today.
You're here to talk about the Governor's Awards for the Arts and Humanities.
Yeah. I'm excited to talk a little bit about it. The event itself is on January 26th in Juneau. We're excited to have people come out. I'll just share a few things that we're going to have a VIP reception at the State Library Archives Museum, and then we'll have the award ceremony itself at the Juneau Arts and Culture Center on the 26th. So we want to really make sure that people are aware of the event and come out and join us.
How long have the arts been given their award and the humanities as well?
Well, so the Arts Council has actually been doing the Junos, the Governor Awards, for more than a decade now. The Alaska Humanities Council has been involved in that for about half that time. But it's a great partnership between our State Humanities Forum and our State Council on the Arts. So it's wonderful that the arts and the humanities are working together to make sure that people are aware of our work and are really honoring people throughout our state for their work in the arts and humanities.
Not just the one award that's given out. There's one for the humanities as well as Artist of the Year and a variety of other ones. Do you have that listed in front of you?
Yeah, I sure do. And just so people know that you can go to the Alaska, it's akgovawards.org, and you can learn more about the event. The other thing I want to make sure I say is that the nominations for the awards, that closes this Friday. So if you have somebody that you want to nominate for one of the awards I'm about to name, please do that as soon as possible. But there's a number of awards. We have the Alaska Studies Educator of the Year Award. There are individual artists awards. And then we have a number of distinguished service to the humanities awards. So there is a variety of awards from Alaska Native Artist, Business Leadership, Arts Education Award. So go on to the site at akgovawards.org and learn more about the awards and about our organizations.
Tell me about the nomination process.
Well, so the way it works is that once the nominations come in, we go through a process of really evaluating them, and the Arts Council evaluates all of the arts awards, and the Humanities Forum Board reviews all of our awards, and we go through a rubric that we use each year, and then artists are selected, and humanities folks are selected. And it's really important that we that process involve a lot of people. So from the arts side, they have current artists, they have people who have been involved in the arts community for a long time involved in that process. And for us, we have people who serve on our board who are writers, who are historians, who are really connected to the humanities community in Alaska. So we feel like it's a really great proper process, and each year we've had amazing awardees.
Tell me about things that people should be sure they include in the nomination form.
Sure. Well, so you want to make sure that not only you're telling the story about the person that you're nominating, but also we ask for there to be some letters of recommendation. And I think the important thing that people should know about this whole event is that we're excited for people to come out. But if you're not able to come out, we also want to encourage you to go onto our site and think about contributing to this event. One of the things that most people may not be aware of is the only way that we're able to put on events like this and to have the kinds of work that the Arts Council and the Humanities Forum do is through contributions of people throughout our state. And so we want to make sure that people are aware of that and that they know that if they contribute to our work, that it not only helps for this event, but it helps for our work throughout the year.
While you're on the phone, tell me about the Alaska Humanities Forum, please.
Sure. So the Alaska Humanities Forum, our mission is to connect Alaskans through ideas, stories, and experiences, and we connect Alaskans. The reason we do that is we do that to strengthen our communities, and we do that to empower people throughout Alaska. And so for more than 43 years now, we have been doing a variety of ways of connecting people through our granting. We run a program called Anchorage, Leadership Anchorage, that's about to hit its 20th year. And we do a lot of work in connecting people from rural Alaska to urban Alaska through our youth programs, through our educator programs. And so for us, it's really about bringing people together and telling the stories of Alaska. And so the people who win these awards are often people who are engaged in our history and our experiences as Alaskans, ensuring that we're telling those stories. And the reason that's so important today is because as we face these really difficult issues like fiscal crisis and rural-urban divide and all of these challenging topics, you know, in our environment, is we need to be having those conversations and basing in our values and our history as Alaskans. And so our work is really about bringing people together and making sure we're having those conversations.
I'm on the phone with Cameron Perez Verdia, talking about the Governor's Awards for the Arts and Humanities. Can you give me the information one more time about what to include as far as the nomination forms?
Sure. So to make sure people know that the awards both for the State Council on the Arts and the awards for the Alaska Humanities Forum are due this Friday, so please turn them in right away. The website is akgovawards.org. And what you want to do is go on there, and it's fully an online platform, and you can nominate who you want through that, and it gives you a lot of information about what kinds of information we're looking for, what the criteria is, and then make sure that you come out and join us on January 26th for the Governor's Arts and Humanities Awards in Juneau, and please join us both for the VIP reception, which is really an opportunity for you to support our work beyond just attending. It's an opportunity for you to invest some funds into the arts and humanities world in Alaska, but then come out for the Governor's Awards as well, and be a part of the fun.
How can people get tickets?
Well, you can go online to the site akgovawards. Or you can go on to the Alaska Humanities site, which is akhf.org, and you can link there as well. So you want to buy tickets both for the Governor's Awards itself, and make sure you come out. It's going to be a lot of fun. The VIP reception is going to have entertainment. It's going to have music. It's going to have a lot of really good fun. And then the event itself is going to have not only speakers, and it's going to have the awardees, but there's going to be entertainment there as well. And each year it's just gotten better and better. So we encourage folks to come out and be a part of it.
And I believe this will also be on 360 North Television and online.
That's right. So if you're not able to come, you can tune in there as well.
Cameron, thanks very much.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Thank you. show coming beaming on through. Tell him fine art is something he don't know, and he'll be the chump that blows you the dough. Baby, I'm a fine artist, and maybe I deserve to be kissed. Keep my palm grease, wear a white leather suit and a bubble toed shoes. Got a $50,000 a year case of the blues. Baby, I'm a fine artist, and maybe I deserve to be kissed.
Zach Crumb is Cheap Suit Serenaders.
We're excited to kick off this year's Karen Ann Spotlight Series with indie folk songwriter duo Dave McGraw and Mandy Fair. Together, their exceptional vocal harmonies coupled with Fair's electric guitar work have become a vehicle to carry them around the world and now returning to the Gold Town Nickelodeon on October 5th. Tickets are at KarenN.org, the station, and the door. Show starts promptly at 7. Again, that's Dave McGraw and Mandy Fair on October 5th at the Gold Town Nick.
Mockingbird singing through the winter, as it suits them as they please. So I don't know why they ever call it lonesome. Won't you be so lonesome way out there? And that is how the story it began there. I love my man and he sure loves me good. We go out walking less than we ought to, make love under the moon less than we should. Under the moon.
Shovel down, digging up, digging up.
Music of Dave McGraw and Mandy Fair.
The Juneau World Affairs Council presents Ambassador Charles Shapiro on current relations with Cuba, September 28th at 5 o'clock at K2360. Ambassador Shapiro was ambassador to Venezuela and director for Cuban affairs at the State Department and currently is the president of the Atlanta World Affairs Council. Again, Ambassador Shapiro will speak on September 28th at 5 o'clock at K2360. Brought to you by the Juneau World Affairs Council, bringing the world to Juneau.
About 3 minutes before the hour, and you are tuned to it in the afternoon. Gold Street Music presents its 13th season with the Huckleberry Pickers, Jerry Rilatos, Tom Loker, Henry and Eric Gunner Hopkins, the Last Chance Jazz Band. The event starts at 7:30 and goes till about 10 o'clock on Saturday, October 1st at Resurrection Lutheran Church at 10th and Glacier Avenue. This month, all donations will go to the Replenish Resurrection Lutheran's food program. Well, the forecast for tonight, scattered showers, cloudy skies with a low around 41 degrees. Forecast for Wednesday, scattered showers before 1 in the afternoon. Cloudy skies with high temperatures near 53 degrees. Wednesday night, mostly cloudy skies. Thursday, sunny weather with high temperatures near 55 degrees.
This is KTOO Juneau. We broadcast.